My name is Don Ring, and I'm a geologist on the faculty of Central Washington University in Ellensburg. The title of the presentation this afternoon is Cascade Volcanoes. If you have any questions as we go along, please wave your arm or holler or something, and I'll certainly be happy to stop and try to answer some questions. I'll also try to leave a little time at the end of the talk to answer any questions that you might have. So if you don't wave or holler, why, you'll just get what what I'm going to or willing to speak about. So without any further ado, let's have a look. There are something over 500 active volcanoes in the world, and the great majority of them are located in places that are, boy, that's a wide beam. Maybe you can kind of pick out the center here, but most of them are located in very long, narrow, linear bands. Actually, about 80% of them are around the Pacific Ocean, one place or another. And our particular volcanoes are part of that sequence. Oddly enough, the same pattern holds true for earthquakes. When they're plotted on a map, why, the pattern is very much the same, and the numbers are about the same, with a great majority of them occurring around the Pacific Ocean, sometimes called the Ring of Fire, but anyway, a very active area as far as earthquakes are concerned. The result of these two things over the, oh, say, last 15 years has been the presentation of a concept known as plate tectonics, with the idea being that the Earth, or the crust of the Earth anyway, the outer surface, is kind of like a shell on an egg, and that egg shell is cracked, and those shells are moving. And it's the places where the shells run into each other that we tend to find volcanoes and earthquakes. And in fact, really most of the so-called activity in geology, the action, so to speak, is in the places where these shells run into one another or are pulling away from one another. And again, you'll notice one of the boundaries tends to run pretty much up the west coast of North America, and this is the area in which we're concerned. In our particular area, the plate boundary is a little bit odd. It runs up the coast of California as the San Andreas Fault, as best we can tell. And then you can see the first sharp line coming off the coastline here. This is just in the very northern California coast, and it comes out like this. Then there's a ridge that runs up here that we call the part of the East Pacific Rise. Actually, it's called the Juan de Fuca Ridge. And this is a place where these two plates are pulling apart. And one little segment here, the Juan de Fuca Ridge, is going toward North America, and the rest of North America over here is actually moving westward. And so we have what we call a collision boundary, a place where two segments of the plates are actually pulling apart. There is a lot of volcanic activity in the pull apart areas, but it usually doesn't show up on the surface. The volcanoes are more likely to show up when they're on the coastline. And over here you can see the nice long string of volcanoes that makes up the Cascade Range, or the Cascade Volcanoes. Looking at it from a side view, it would be something like this, with the Juan de Fuca plate coming like this and running into the other North American plate, and the oceanic plate, in, as it were, running down and under the other plate. And the result is to have volcanoes occurring on the continent. And this one shows Mount St. Helens, but it's fairly typical of the Cascade Volcanoes. Actually, the Cascade Volcanoes start with Mount Garibaldi in British Columbia, but since that's in another country, we're not going to worry about it for now. And I'm going to kind of pick up the story with Mount Baker, which is off to the north and west of us here. Mount Baker became modestly active about 10 years ago, and it's gasped and burbled a little bit ever since. It's put off a little steam, a little ash, nothing very exciting, but at least enough to keep geologists guessing and looking. If you look at Mount Baker, you may see the kind of dark ridge over on the west side of the mountain. This is a remnant of the older Mount Baker, a predecessor to the mountain that's there now. And this is quite typical of most of the Cascade volcanoes. Most of them are kind of built in the wreckage of other volcanoes that may have been bigger or wider or at least somewhat different than the ones that are there now. And this is a fairly typical pattern all the way down through. Mount Baker happens to show up as a fairly good example. Glacier Peak is almost due west of us here. It's one of the lesser known volcanoes. It's a little bit smaller and kind of isolated out in the Cascades. It's one that you really have to kind of put yourself out to get to because it is somewhat isolated. It's given its name because it does have several rather large extensive glaciers that run down the side of the peak. It also had a fairly major eruption, about 12,000 years ago. It hasn't had much activity since then, as best we can tell, but in the process, it threw out a rather substantial amount of ash, most of which went off to the south and east, as you can see by the dark area here. Actually, since this was made, they have found some of the ash in Yellowstone Park, so it went at least that far. You can see also some of it around here in places, if you happen to hit the right spot, and occasionally even on along the stream, if you poke along or in some of the places where they've done some excavating for gravel, you may find bits of pumice that were part of the Mount Glacier or the Glacier Peak eruption. So it did carry pretty well into this area, and there are little remnants of the eruption still around. Mount Rainier is sort of the mountain in the Cascade. It's the biggest one, and it's the closest one to population centers. So when people talk about Cascade volcanoes, at least up until Mount St. Helens erupted, everybody tended to talk about Mount Rainier. It also is a kind of a remnant of what was once a bigger volcano. You can see a little Tahoma off to the on the east side of it. I've heard people say that Little Tahoma is a smaller volcano, but it isn't. It's just simply a remnant of what was once a bigger Mount Rainier. It looks like probably when Mount Rainier was really at its greatest height, it may have been as much as 2,000 feet higher than it is now. But over the years, it's undergone some rather explosive eruptions, and so much of that height has been dwindled down a little bit by eruptions that appear to be very much like the ones that occurred at Mount St. Helens. We call the Cascade volcanoes stratovolcanoes mainly because they're built layer upon layer. The eruptive material, the ash, the pumice, the lavas that come out are all relatively thick and gooey, and consequently they don't run very far when they come out of the opening in the top of the volcano. They tend to kind of pile up on the side of the volcano, and this results then in the building up of the mountain rather than having it spread out or spraddle out, say like the Hawaiian volcanoes do. And of course it's a much different kind of lava than the Hawaiian volcanoes. Our principal kind of lava we call andesite. The Hawaiian eruptions are primarily basalt, and the basaltic lavas come up much hotter and much more fluid, and consequently they run much more freely. In the case of the Cascade volcanoes, as I say, the lavas are thick and gooey, and so they tend to build kind of like a layer cake going up. And here on the south side of Mount Rainier, you can see some of that layer cake pattern. And again, Mount Rainier shows this perhaps better than most of the others because it's been rather carved up by the glaciers, and you can get a better look at what the peak looks like. This is the Carbon Glacier area on the north side. most of the mountains is covered with glacial ice, and the glaciers kind of run off. It's sort of there. Well, Mount Rainier really is kind of like a big marshmallow sundae, I guess, with all the ice and snow piled on the top, and then just running down in little valleys and channels off either side. But Carbon Glacier has its own little basin from which it flows, and again, you can see some of the layering in the side of the basin where the glacier has cut back into the mountain. Mount Rainier is also the oldest of the Cascade volcanoes. The oldest rocks that have been dated here are about 700 to 800,000 years. Now, it's very difficult to know how old a volcano like this is because being built up layer by layer, the oldest layer is buried at the bottom of the pile, and it's very difficult to see. So sometimes we can't get too much of a good idea as to how old they are. Here, where the glacier is cut back kind of into the center of the mountain, it's been possible to get some of the older layers. And so we do know that the oldest layers here are about 700 or 800,000 years. So basically, or geologically, they're generally pretty young. They've not been around all that long. Mount Rainier has a very definite crater in the top. It looks like this much of the year because there is steam and hot gases and things that come up continually around the opening in the top of Mount Rainier. And snow doesn't accumulate there as a rule. In fact, a couple of years ago, there were some guys in a light plane who took a late afternoon flight up there and ended up dumping the plane just down below the summit of the mountain. And knowing nobody was going to find him that night, why, the pilot had the foresight to take his passenger, and they climbed up into the crater and sat in one of the steam caves all night. And aside from getting some burned buns, why, they survived very nicely. And otherwise, being, I think, December when they did this, they probably would have frozen to death. But the next morning, why, the plane was spotted very quickly, and they were rescued very quickly. But it does indicate that there is a fair bit of activity going on there yet, even though it hasn't erupted for some years. The glaciers on the mountain are, as I say, probably some of the biggest anywhere in the state. This is the Emmons Glacier on the, almost on the due east side of the mountain, one of the biggest and longest of the glaciers. This was taken in 1962, and you can see the end of the glacier is about right in here. And the glacier, like most Cascade glaciers, had been receding for a long period of years. You can see the lack of vegetation along the valley, which indicates the glacier had been there probably in the not-too-distant past. And so the glacier had moved down the mountain some distance and then was now in the process of pulling back. This was taken last year, and I think you can see the difference in the end of the glacier. It's a much more rolling front, as we call it. It's very steep. The glacier has moved down the valley some distance. And so Emmons, anyway, has become a fairly active or actively advancing glacier, and indicates that everything on the mountain is probably in a pretty good state of health, because it means that there's been a lot of precipitation, a lot of snowfall, and this is gradually causing the glacier to advance down the valley. Now, it looks like it's kind of stabilized now, but at any rate, it has been moving now for maybe the last 15 or 20 years. Mount Adams, again, is a little bit of an unknown. It sits at least in part on the Yakima Indian Reservation, and it's always been sort of a sacred mountain to the Yakimas, and they have very much frowned on geologists going up there and poking around, so it hasn't been extensively mapped. It doesn't have much of a recorded history of eruption. It has a couple of fairly active glaciers on it, as you can see. This picture also perhaps typifies a little bit of the Cascade volcanoes in the sense that these volcanoes are built on top of the Cascades. With the one exception perhaps might be Mount St. Helens, which is kind of down off the edge. But as you can see here by the line along this area, the mountains kind of have a good running start. When we say Mount Rainier is over 14,000 feet high, this is a little bit of a cheat because it has about a 6,000 foot running start provided by the height of the Cascades where it began to erupt. And so most of the Cascade volcanoes are built on this relatively high platform. This is a pre-eruption Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens, of course, is certainly by now perhaps the most famous of the Cascade volcanoes, maybe along with Mount Rainier, but having erupted about 4 years ago, it was a very spectacular peak because it was so symmetrical and neat. People called it the Fujiyama of the Cascades because of its symmetry, and of course geologists recognized that symmetry was also an indication that it was a very active volcano because it meant that in spite of the action of glaciers and erosion, it was keeping that symmetry by periodically erupting and erasing any signs of erosion that might have occurred. This is the mountain as it looked again prior to eruption, looking across Spirit Lake. The little enclave down here in the corner was the home of the other Harry Truman, who became rather famous for his comments about the fact that he wasn't going to leave and all this sort of thing, and so Harry got his wish because that's where he stayed. But again, you can see some of the symmetry of the peak. It started to erupt a little bit in March of 1980 and kind of fizzled and burbled and blew ash and made the geologists all excited for a pattern of time. You can see here because of the prevailing west winds why the west side of the mountain is relatively ash-free and the east side is pretty much blanketed with ash. And it kept on that activity for, well, through April and on into May. Opened up a fairly large vent and put out steam and generally made itself fairly active. But the one thing that concerned the geologists was the fact that down here in the, well, very much on the north side, right above Spirit Lake, there was a big bulge beginning to develop. And the bulge was growing quite rapidly, oh, maybe 3, 4, 5 feet a day. And everybody recognized that that bulge would probably become unstable and the result would be a fairly major avalanche into the Spirit Lake area. And this was the reason for wanting people to stay away from Spirit Lake. Nobody really quite anticipated how disastrous that avalanche would be because when it finally kicked loose, it also allowed the eruption to occur, and as the big avalanche moved down the side of the mountain, it released the pressures that were being built up actually by molten rock and gaseous pressures. The first part of that was an explosion that went upward, and then the next thing was an explosion that went almost straight out from the north side of the mountain. And this was something that nobody had really quite anticipated, the force of that lateral blast, the one that went kind of parallel to the ground surface. You can see again here the incidentally, these were taken from the National Geographic, which probably made some of the nicest illustrations of what actually happened by combining some line drawings or cartoons with actual pictures of the eruption. The neat thing about the eruption is it was quite extensively photographed because there were people up there, it was a Sunday, and there were photographers up there that had their cameras set up and taking pictures periodically, and so a number of them were in good position to get some excellent pictures. In fact, there was a geologist flying over the volcano when this all started, and so all combined, why it's probably one of the best recorded eruptions in history. Anyway, here we go back to sort of a before and after. This is a picture again of Mount St. Helens as it looked before the eruption. This is a mountain from the same vantage point afterwards. Now, I hate to admit this, but I wasn't in the state when it erupted. I was off in Nevada with a group of students on a field excursion. In fact, I think in our department, nobody was home. everybody had gone off someplace for the weekend. But so anyway, I didn't get to experience all this, and I found some of the things out secondhand as I got back in the state after a couple of being gone for a couple of weeks. But it was difficult for me to believe when I first heard the stories that 1,300 feet to the top of the mountain had disappeared. I just couldn't envision an eruption quite that explosive. And finally, where we were, we saw some sequential pictures in the paper, and then it finally made a believer out of me. So it did take a substantial part of the mountain away. Again, from the National Geographic, a couple of before and after pictures taken from the same vantage point. You really can't believe how destructive it was until you've had a chance to go in there. And if you have an opportunity, I highly recommend that you take one of the trips in. Now there are some very excellent access roads. You can drive almost directly up under the peak, and it's a very sobering sight. No matter how many pictures like this you see, it will never take the place of going in and seeing for yourself the fact that a Douglas fir that was 3 feet in diameter can be just broken off right at the ground and be nothing but a few shattered splinters and things standing up there. Or tipped over, or whatever might have happened. This is the mountain again after the eruption. Spirit Lake exists now, but it's, I think, about 300 feet higher than it was before. By that I mean the surface and the floor of the lake have been raised that much. Most of the avalanche material came down and actually completely splashed the lake up to the north, filled in the basin, and then as the water came back down, it went into what was left of the old basin, and so there it sits on top of this tremendous pile of avalanche debris. And of course, yes, well, the total amount of material that disappeared, as I recall, is something less than a cubic mile. So part of that is avalanche debris, and part of it went off in ash. Now, I don't recall offhand seeing a guesstimate as to how much of it actually ended up in ash. Part of that ash, of course, is new material. Some of it is probably material that was part of that cone, but most of the top of the mountain ended up going down as avalanche debris, and most of the ash, I think, has turned out to be relatively new material. So basically, the top of the mountain as such ended up going down into Spirit Lake and then on down the Tootle and some of the other streams that are there. This is part of the road that goes in there now. If you go in to what the Forest Service calls Windy Point, or I guess maybe the Park Service now, you have a very excellent road right, as I say, right up to almost to the base of the peak, right up looking down Spirit Lake or down on Spirit Lake, and it's well worth the trip and a very, very accessible trip, one that I think a lot of people should avail themselves of. One of the really spectacular things about the eruption was that as the ash and gas cloud rolled out of the mountain, here you have a cloud of very hot, very dense material. Guesstimates are that it probably went up in the neighborhood of 500 or 600 degrees. And as it rolled along, it just literally bowled over or tore off the trees and things that were there and just laid them down like jackstraws, almost always in the direction that the cloud was moving. And then right at the fringe, all of a sudden you find a place like this where the trees right here are all torn down or pushed over. Then there's maybe anywhere from 100 to 300 foot zone where the trees are all singed. They're still standing. A lot of the branches have been burned off and maybe some of the bark burned off. And then all of a sudden you're into brand new green untouched forest. And this is true almost all the way around the fringe. So it indicates that the temperatures were extremely high. In fact, they tend to sort of flash through, and they go by so quickly that it doesn't actually set fire to much. It just kind of singes it off, and then the heat's gone, and everything's left standing. This is Spirit Lake as of last fall, which is the last time I was in there. It's still about half covered with forest debris. As I said, the lake was splashed off to the north, and then as it came back down, it picked up all these dead trees and loose material, washed it back down into the lake basin, and so it still covers about half the lake. I don't know what'll ever happen to it. I assume eventually most of it will get waterlogged and sink, so it's going to be a very organic lake for a lot of years to come, because it's going to take a long time to get that stuff out. The area is gradually coming back to life, a little bit here and a little bit there, so it will probably eventually come back to somewhat like it is now, but it's going to take a long, long time before it completely recovers. This picture was taken by a friend during the eruption. As I said, I wasn't there, but the general description was that it was very much like a huge thundercloud coming in. In fact, that's what most of the people thought initially, was that it was just a big thunderstorm. And then gradually it got darker and darker until ultimately it just made everything go into complete blackness until the ash cloud had passed and everything had kind of settled out. It had a very strange pattern to it, because much of the ash was blown up into the air and then picked up by the prevailing winds and then carried out into the middle of the state. Ellensburg got, maybe half an inch or so, and same with Yakima, but as one got a little bit further east, it got worse and worse. This is one of my friends who happened to get caught in the ash fall and happened to stay overnight in Moses Lake. And they're on the patio of another friend looking at the ash pile and wondering what to do. And actually over around Richville, which is between Moses Lake and Spokane, was probably about the worst hit of any place in the state. So there was a lot of flyover. The ash carried on over much of the area between Mount St. Helens and those areas, and then landed kind of out in the middle of the state. So it was a very different kind of ash fall. Now, I think if you travel through most of this country, if you didn't know what you were looking at or looking for, well, you probably would have some difficulty even seeing it. There is still quite a bit around the Moses Lake to Richville area, but the average person probably would never notice the ash or pay much attention to what it was. Right now, the mountain is back in the process of dome building. The lavas that are coming up are very thick, gooey lavas, and gradually it's building a new dome inside the old volcano or the old crater. And ultimately, given a little luck, it'll probably build itself back into a fairly nice symmetrical cone. These kind of eruptions have happened before at Mount St. Helens and other mountains too, and we recognize now that fact a little bit more than we did before that eruption. So it's kind of a part of the cycle that seems to occur in a lot of the Cascade volcanoes. We might expect it to occur perhaps in others as years go on. This is Mount Hood, the northernmost of the Oregon volcanoes. Kind of a symbol, I suppose, to Portland because it is fairly close to Portland. It had erupted not too far in the past, forming a little vent kind of down here on the south side, but it hasn't had too much activity in recent times, and probably, at least at this point in time, appears to be fairly stable, although that's kind of a questionable statement sometimes. The volcanoes in that part of the state are a little bit better preserved, and maybe Oregon's had a little bit more recent activity. So from Mount Hood, which you can see here on south, one sees a whole lot more small volcanoes. There are some pretty good sized stratovolcanoes too, but there are also a lot more of the smaller volcanoes that show up in the Oregon Cascades, far more than we usually see in Washington. This is Mount Jefferson, which is a fairly good-sized volcanic peak, rather symmetrical, and again indicates that its eruptive pattern is one that's been fairly active. Then you go on down into the Sisters, more in the area of Bend. Again, fairly old volcanoes, not too much recent activity. This is Mount Bachelor, which is a very popular ski area just a little bit to the south and west of Bend. You can see the ski runs going down the side of the peak, and now I think they've actually gotten the run so they can ski all the way around the mountain. But you can also see off to the upper left-hand side and then kind of down to the lower right some smaller cinder cones, which are small volcanoes that have occurred over the years, and this is fairly typical of the Oregon Cascades. Another well-known volcano is Crater Lake. Now, Crater Lake actually is the lake. The mountain itself is called Mount Mazama, and Mount Mazama is kind of the classic example of what we call a caldera. A caldera is the name for just a very large volcanic vent, usually one that's more than a mile across. Actually, the top of Mount St. Helens now is a caldera, although you don't hear it referred to as that very often. But Crater Lake is kind of the classic caldera because it's such a beautiful one. It has the lake setting, and it's about 4 to 5 miles across, so it's a little bit bigger than it needs to be classed as a caldera. It erupted about a little less than 7,000 years ago, and in the process, during the eruption cycle, the whole top of the mountain just simply collapsed. It sort of fell into itself, as the term might be. And the nice thing about it is that it gave us a little bit of a look into the inner workings of a big stratovolcano, because when that collapse occurred, now we can see what some of the inner plumbing looks like, because we can see places where the layers go up like this and they show up along the edge of the caldera. So it's a good chance to see what some of that volcanic plumbing is actually like. Again, I think Crater Lake lost maybe a couple thousand feet of elevation during the collapse. If one projects some of these layers off into the air, why, that seems to be the usual indication for size. Way off in the background, you can see one of the flows that came out, and notice the kind of neat round bottom that it has. Crater Lake, or Mount Mazama, I should say, had been extensively glaciated prior to the last eruption. And during the eruption, when the collapse occurred, or prior to the collapse in this case, some of the lavas had gone down some of those glaciated valleys. And there are other places along the edge where the valleys were just simply cut off. As the top of the mountain dropped, where you find nice, what we call U-shaped valleys going right up to the edge of the mountain. In the foreground here is Wizard Island, which is a little cinder cone. Wizard Island was built sometime after the eruption, and actually there are two or three other cinder cones that are underneath the level of the lake. The lake is about 2,000 feet deep, and of course this is
water that has accumulated over a long period of time from snow and rain and so forth. It's a closed basin, and so gradually as the water has accumulated, while the other volcanoes that are inside the caldera have gradually been covered up with water. So Wizard Island is the only visible remnant now that actually sticks up above the level of the lake. Here you can see a little bit closer view. It has a nice little crater in the top. In the foreground, these are some of the lava flows that came out during the eruption, and so now the lake rather nicely surrounds it, and it makes a very distinctive marker inside Crater Lake. It gives it a lot more character, I guess. Looking at the pattern of distribution, here's Crater Lake down in the southwestern part of Oregon, and the ash from Crater Lake covered really almost all the Northwest, most of Washington, Oregon, on into southern Canada, most of Idaho were blanketed. In fact, even now you can go up to Osage Snoqualmie Pass and dig a hole in one of the old bogs there, and you'll find a layer of ash that's probably 3 or 4 inches thick after almost 7,000 years. If you went up there and looked for ash from Mount St. Helens, you wouldn't find any. So it had to be a rather traumatic eruption because it covered such a large area, at least in our part of the country, to such a depth. And I'm sure it was rather appalling for the animals and the people who lived here at that time. The next major volcano going south is Shasta, and then Shastina, which is a little parasite. I shouldn't say a little parasite, a big parasite volcano built on the side of Mount Shasta. I think the records indicate that Shastina is actually the third or fourth highest volcano in the Cascade, so being a parasite to Mount Shasta has probably taken away from some of its own grandeur, but it is a very striking feature. And again, Shastina has erupted geologically in fairly recent times, so there is that possibility again that Mount Shasta could become active. The last of the Cascade volcanoes is Mount Lassen. And Mount Lassen has a couple of unique things about it. Mount Lassen is what we call a plug dome, and you can see the higher part of the peak of Mount Lassen. And apparently this was pushed up somewhat like the dome is forming in Mount St. Helens now. It was pushed up as an almost solid mass of volcanic material and then gradually hardened, or maybe was fairly hardened even as it was being pushed up. And of course, Mount Lassen erupted in the early 1900s and stayed active for about 6 years. It also had some eruptive patterns very much like Mount St. Helens. It started rather slowly and quietly and then went into a fairly explosive stage after a somewhat longer period of time than Mount St. Helens did, and then gradually died down. And there are some interesting old photographs of the eruption, but it was a long ways away from anybody, and of course the media was not then what it is now, and so it wasn't quite so extensively reported on or photographed or anything like this. And the eruption certainly wasn't quite in the same class as the one at Mount St. Helens, but at least it should have given us perhaps a little more warning of what the eruptions can be like, because it did devastate a fairly large area along the side of the mountain before it was finally done. 20, 30, 40 miles below the surface, there are some areas where the chambers are a little bit shallower than others, but most of the time it comes from fairly good depth. One thing you have to realize, and a lot of people don't, is that the inside of the Earth is essentially solid. The magmas are released primarily by the release of pressure, so you have material there that's under high temperature but very high pressure that keeps it as a solid. If that pressure is relieved by fracturing or breaking or whatever process, then it's kind of, I say it's kind of like sticking up a carbonated beverage in a container. As long as you don't pop the cork, it's not going to do anything. Once you pop the cork,
then of course it comes boiling out primarily as a gas and liquid material. And that's basically what a volcanic eruption is. And something has to pop the cork, otherwise the rock material will stay solid. Now, some places like Hawaii probably have a fairly ongoing magma chamber right under the mountain because there is so much continuous activity, but that's somewhat the exception. Mammoth Lake is a very large caldera. Mammoth Lake is kind of like Yellowstone Park. Yellowstone Park is a big caldera, and so is the Mammoth Lake region. And well, in fact, we were in the Mammoth Lake area right after the Mount St. Helens eruption, and they were, well, the people up here were having volcanoes, we were having earthquakes. And I think about a year ago, or maybe a little more than a year ago, the Geological Survey gave what they called a volcanic hazard warning to the Mammoth Lakes area, saying that with all the recent activity that's been there and with all the earthquake activity that's going on now, and all the old indications of volcanic material and hot springs and things like that, that they felt there was an excellent chance of having some more eruptions in that area. May never happen. Geologists are very reluctant to make predictions, but they certainly felt obligated in this case, I guess, to at least give the people some advanced warning. Well, I guess I have my my doubts about tapping the volcanoes for geothermal. There were two holes drilled just on the sides, well, you know, just out of the actual flanks of Mount St. Helens about a year before the eruption, and they didn't find anything out of the line at all. In fact, they didn't find enough warm water to even warrant any further looking. Geothermal, and you have to understand something about geothermal. People want to say, well, geothermal is one of our big saviors, and the same people might poke their, go bananas if oil company X wanted to go in there and drill a hole, but they'd clap their hands if some geothermal company wanted to go in. Well, there is no difference. They're both tapping a natural resource, and in both cases, you have to go in there, drill holes, find out if there's any hot water or steam or what have you there. Somebody's going to have to take up a certain amount of land to produce the steam, and you're going to have to build plants to generate electricity or whatever you're going to do with it. So geothermal, or if you accept geothermal, you've got to also pat the oil companies on the back, because they're doing exactly the same thing for just a different kind of energy. So don't get sucked in by geothermal if you look at the remote areas as being something that should be sacred, because there is absolutely no difference at all. And the same thing applies, I guess, to geothermal as it does to oil, and that is that once you tap the reservoir, there's a limit to how long it's going to last. Even the heat in a given area is not unlimited. Some areas certainly are better than others, but well, that's true. You still have to build a generating plant there, but basically I guess the same thing is true of oil. I don't know that it makes a big blot on the landscape either, except with a refinery. If you spill it, I guess it does, but a lot of geothermal systems do the same thing. You've got a highly mineralized water running around, and if you slop it all over, why, you're going to have trouble too. So what I really want you to understand is that basically exploring and getting it out of the ground and developing it are no different whether you're talking about oil or geothermal. Oil, of course, has definite short-term toxic effects, but oil is also a natural material, and nature tends to bounce back very quickly after oil spills. They're very damaging for in the short term, but in the long term, why, they seem to things seem to get over it rather easily. Well, that's still up for arguments, I guess. You hear a lot of stories pro and con over the carbon dioxide that goes into the atmosphere from coal and oil and things like this, and wood, I guess, and how that's going to affect the systems over a long period of time. And that's something I don't think anybody really agrees on at this point in time, whether there is an ongoing or oncoming greenhouse effect, or whether maybe it is detrimental or beneficial, or one scientist will say one thing and one will say another. So at this point, I guess the best thing we can say is I don't think anybody really knows. May find out years and years and years from now, but maybe when we do, it'll be too late or too early. So at this point, I don't think we really know. Well, not the whole park, but really the whole central area where all the geyser basins and all those things are. Actually, if you're familiar with the lake at all, West Thumb is a very small caldera within a caldera, but the main part of the central Yellowstone Park is a large caldera. You can recognize it if you kind of know what to look for, but it's certainly nothing like Crater Lake. It's not quite that same kind of. Well, yeah, there are lots of calderas in this country that are much bigger than that. Maybe a confined caldera in the sense that it might be a caldera like the one at Mount St. Helens or Crater Lake, where you can actually see the rim and the ridge. But we have calderas in this country that are 50, 60 miles, 70 miles, 100 miles across. So thank you for your patience.